Hello, 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 and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. Both, you have reached Johnny Has the Keys, hence the great green graphic that you see everywhere. My name is David. I'm here with Tim. We are two guys who discuss movies, television, literature, horror, and science fiction genres in particular. We discuss key influences of those particular topics and things that they may have in turn influenced. If you're joining us for the first time, yay, great. Hope you enjoy it and hope you'll like us. Give us a little bit of a good review, ring a bell, subscribe, do all those things that help us. As Tim is oft to say on the podcast, it's a small thing to you, may take just a few seconds of your time, but it really, really helps us, helps other people find the podcast and the YouTube channel and all of that fun stuff. As I said, my name's David. I'm here with Tim. Hey, Tim.
Hello.
I love the background. That is awesome.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho. It's almost Christmas.
Merry Christmas. I have a vault of EC comics behind me.
That is incredible. Yes. Those of you who are listening, Tim has, it's just a myriad collage of EC comics.
Yeah.
So it's great.
Yeah, I thought it would be appropriate for our topic today.
Yes.
But first, most of the people out there that are familiar with us are used to us talking about something we did genre related this week.
Yeah.
But since it's almost Christmas, I put together a little list that I sent you.
Yes.
That I thought we could talk about a bit.
Sure.
We are 15, as of today, episodes into our fourth season. So we're almost halfway.
Yeah.
And we are almost 4 years into the podcast. Mm-hmm. So we've covered a lot of movies. We did our 100th this year.
Yeah, I just re-listened to Hereditary, and we argue about Midsommar almost all the way through it. I keep going, we covered that on the podcast, and you're going, no, we didn't.
We haven't.
You didn't. You're an idiot. Shut up. And I'm like, I know we did, but does get confusing. You know, there are times when I go, did we talk about that during the podcast as an episode, or was that what we did in our genre week, or was that, you know, whatever? I get confused.
Yeah, I could see that. And a lot of times I use the genre week to explore newer movies for future episodes too.
Right.
Like there's been a couple already this year that are going to probably pop up next year in the show.
That's going to get real confusing.
Yeah, it is. And there's a lot of overlap, which is why this list was born. I keep saying some of our better episodes are bad movies because we're really funny in those episodes. But most of the time when we do a bad movie or a good bad movie, like a Basket Case by Frank Henenlotter, or a movie like Splinter that's just so off the radar that most people haven't seen it, we never cover that director again. However, we do so many good movies that we're seeing a lot of overlap. And I thought I'd put together a list. I thought it would take me a few minutes. It took about 3 hours. There's a lot.
There's a lot.
And so I guess we could take it. I don't know.
Who's our biggest? Who have we covered the most?
The most that we have covered. I'll give you a guess. I challenged it, but I was wrong. A few weeks back,
It wasn't Corm. It wasn't. Is it Spielberg?
Yeah,
Spielberg's the most. Okay,
well, Spielberg's the one. I was thinking that James Cameron was going to be it, because you have a love for one and a disgust for the
other. Yeah. Right. Right. I cannot, you know, I loved it when we did Aliens, and you said, you know, we've covered him quite a lot, and I'm like. I guess we have to. He's got a legacy. You know, we can't deny that.
Oh, no. And what's funny is that we're not through with either one of them. They both have upcoming episodes this season.
We'll add to the list.
So we have 5 by Spielberg and 4 by Cameron, but we will soon have 6 and 5, respectively. Okay.
Adding each.
Yeah.
What about Hitchcock? Do we have Hitchcock? We've only done one or two of his. We've done two of his.
We've done... let me see here.
Because I thought we did the Birds.
Yeah, actually, we've done 2 of Hitchcock. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't sure. I thought I had my phone on silent, if you just heard that little ding.
Kubrick. We've done Shining. I think that's all we've done by him.
Right? No, we've done The Shining in 2001 and soon to be another this season.
Okay.
So we don't want to give away any surprises, you guys. But yeah, so that's another. He's up there in the top four. Do you know who number three is, though? Kubrick's number four.
No.
Number three would be Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott. Well, good.
Right.
Yeah.
We've covered three of his movies. No more this season, but we've covered Alien, Blade Runner, and The Martian.
And he's got a new movie out. He's working on a new Alien, from what I've been told. We'll see.
Well, and he's producing Noah Hawley's series for Fox. That's an Alien series as well.
Oh, yay.
I cannot wait because I love Noah Hawley.
I like Noah Hawley, so that might be great. Yeah.
I'm curious. So if he can bring that Fargo magic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then number five in the top five is George Romero.
George Romero. Well, and how interesting.
That's very interesting because we might be covering one of his movies today.
Today, even.
Yeah. So far, we've done Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, of course. And
right.
We'll get to that one coming up today in just a moment. Let's look at some of these other ones here.
I mean, we had said Ari Aster, but we haven't done any Ari Aster, have we?
Yeah, we did. You just mentioned Hereditary.
Oh, wait. I get him confused. Who did The Witch?
Robert Eggers.
Eggers.
The Witch.
Okay. Sorry.
And we have not covered Mr. Eggers yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if he happens soon.
And
we may or may not be covering him later this season.
Ooh. Hint, hint.
Yeah.
And
he's great. He did The Lighthouse, too. I don't know if you saw that movie.
I have not. It's on my list.
Yeah, it's really good, but it's really strange.
And we haven't done, we did Flanagan with all of Hill Street, Hill House, sorry, and
Dr. Sleep.
And Dr. Sleep. Mm-hmm. But we haven't done what's his name, the Wan guy. James Wan?
You're right. We have not done a James Wan. As a matter of fact, we should probably correct that. I should probably put him on purposefully next year. None of his come to mind, but I'm sure that if I go and look, I can figure out which one has done the best and maybe go with that.
Yeah.
I think he did The Conjuring. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Because he did the new one, Malignant.
Mm-hmm.
That's Juan too. So, yeah.
I tell you what I can do really quickly. I can name 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 directors that we've only done one film of that we're going to do repeats of this year.
Really? Out. We're going to do second?
We're going to do second BIPs in the upcoming 2022 half of this season.
Okay.
With Wes Craven, Toby Hooper, Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm sorry. We already did Toby Hooper because it was Salem's Lot last week.
Yep.
Joss Whedon, Brian De Palma. Mm-hmm. We did Carrie, but we have another one.
Oh, yeah.
James Whale.
Ooh.
Go back to 1930s. Frankenstein. We're going to do another one of his upcoming season. Luc Besson.
Yes.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. I mean, as far as what I would call foreign directors, I think Luc Besson falls into my sci-fi, foreign director category that I like.
Okay.
Because his movies to me feel like foreign films. They're not in a different language, but they have a very
quirky
European aesthetic, I think, to them.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, so.
And I haven't seen the one that we're doing.
Oh, upcoming, good.
So, yeah.
That'll be good.
And then the seventh is Terrence Fisher. We have another Terrence Fisher of Hammer Films coming up this year.
Hey,
Hammer. Well, other directors that we have already covered two of, we've covered two John Carpenters, The Fly. I mean, excuse me, The Thing and Halloween. David Cronenberg's The Fly and The Brood.
Yep.
Mike Flanagan, we mentioned Hill House and Dr. Sleep. Danny Boyle, we did Sunshine and 28 Days Later.
Wow.
Dennis Villeneuve, we did Blade Runner. It's Blade Runner, the sequel, excuse me, and Arrival.
Yeah, we may have to do the new Dune as like a Patreon thing for our special Patreon people, you know, because it's getting very mixed reviews, which is interesting.
Did I see a commercial that had Dave Bautista and that Aquaman in it?
Yeah, they're both in it.
Okay.
I'm already
on the wrong side of this field.
We did Lynch's version, and Bautista plays the big guy. Do you remember Sting's brother in the
yes
the big guy? That's who Bautista is playing.
Okay.
And Jason Momoa actually is doing the Max von Sydow character the way it is in the novel and the way it should be. He'll have a much bigger role in this version.
I'll take your word for it.
But yeah, it's interesting that this year they're doing two huge sci-fi classics. They're remaking Dune, and sci-fi or HBO, some Netflix, somebody is doing Foundation.
I think it's Apple, isn't it?
Yeah, Apple Plus is doing Foundation, which is the, you know, the Isaac Asimov huge series of novels.
But that's not a remake.
No, but it's a huge sci-fi piece of literature. You know, it was the basis of a lot of other, has a lot of keys in it, put it that way. Yeah.
Mm.
So Foundation is very unique. And multi generational.
I don't know when I'll get to see it because I'm not an Apple person.
Well, I might have to send you a link or something. We'll find
out. We cut the cable and we just stream now.
Which is pretty normal, yeah. I think, for people out there now.
Yeah.
I mean, especially, I mean, you can upgrade to like Hulu Plus and even get broadcast.
Well, so we did the tier that included Disney Plus and
ESPN, of course,
which
did.
We don't need. Yeah. But the I forgot what I was going to say.
Cutting the cable and doing the Prime channels.
Oh, right. I mean, I'm still getting the things I want, though. I was worried about Walking Dead, but I'm still getting Walking Dead. Oh, I know what it was. I was going to say that even though we're doing a lot more streaming, we're still saving $70 by cutting cable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
Monthly, that is. Yeah. And
that was your little Christmas present to yourselves?
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Back where we left off, Alfonso Cuarón, we've done two of Gravity, Children of Men. You mentioned Hitchcock, Psycho and the Birds. Jacques Tourneur, we did Cat People and Curse of the Demon. I love how we, even the obscure directors, we've got two of. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Richard Fleischer, Fantastic Voyage, and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
20,000 Leagues.
The Russo brothers, both Avengers movies, Infinity and Endgame, Infinity War and Endgame. And then, of course, George Miller. We did both Mad Max and Road Warrior. Robert Wise.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? I take that back. I've already gone into another category. George Miller will soon be three because we're doing another of his this year.
Good, good, good.
We've done two Robert Wise, soon to be three this year. We've done The Day the Earth Stood Still and The Andromeda Strain, and we have another coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we already mentioned that George Romero is the same. That's all I had. I just wanted to recap some of that for some of you folks out there that may have missed one of those episodes. They're out there.
Yeah, they're in the library, so you can look them up, watch or listen. You can listen through. When did we start YouTube? Season 3 or season 2? I can't remember.
I can't either. I think it was like 5 episodes into season 3.
Into season 3. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think
because we didn't start at the very beginning.
They're out there. And also, I personally would love to hear from our listener viewers. Are there directors they want us to cover? Are there
absolutely
things, are there directors that out there that you think deserve to get the Johnny has the keys treatment sort of thing. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for those of you that do catch us via YouTube, the episodes are there. They're just audio. I put everything on YouTube with just, if it's just audio, it'll have just our logo in the background while you're listening to it.
Okay, so even season one and two.
Yeah, season one and two are on there, just audio. And then okay. Eventually the visuals come early season three. So
yes. So like, yeah, you need those visuals.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No, but.
Visual.
But.
Video killed the radio star, David.
Well, and, you know, I know with, you know, Instagram, TikTok, everything is visual. And I'm mm-hmm. like, okay, yeah, sure.
It is.
We'll do that.
It is. Oh, you know, I didn't mention other directors we covered that we have potential for future, even though they may not be this year. Mm. Those directors would be Sam Raimi, the Wachowskis, I can't say that, Christopher yep. Nolan, Jordan Peele, Dario Argento, Richard Donner, Don Coscarelli, Ken Russell, Stuart mm. Gordon, M. Night Shyamalan, Zack Snyder. Did I say it wrong?
I don't know. I always say Shyamalan, like Shyamalan.
Okay, but that may be right. Zack Snyder, Roger Corman, Paul Verhoeven, Ari Aster, as you mentioned, Robert Eggers, David Lynch, Jack Arnold, Neil Marshall, Terry Gilliam, Guillermo del Toro, Todd Browning, and Robert Zemeckis.
Wow. That's what we've got coming up.
Some of those may be coming up too. I just realized. Because
you mentioned two of them and I immediately went, ooh, no, we haven't
this
covered
this is our
them
Christmas yet. Present to everybody. You yeah. may be getting a sneak peek or at least a sneak clue of some things.
Clues of coming up. Like yeah. what could we possibly be doing by some of those artists, as it were.
Yeah. Well, back to George Romero.
Yeah, him.
Who I am rapidly discovering, well, I've always known, but I'm appreciating him more as a director. There's a movie out. I don't know if you've seen it. It's got good ratings, but it was a film of his that was lost that recently got released. Did you see that? It's called The Amusement Park.
Mm-hmm, or something like that. It takes place in an amusement park.
Yeah, it's a 60-minute, like, film he was commissioned to direct for some company, but mm-hmm. it's getting like really high marks on Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm like, why? Because I didn't think it was just a traditional movie, so I've been reluctant to watch it, but I guess I'm gonna have to check it out.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds interesting. It didn't look great to
no,
me.
No, I didn't think so either.
But then again, you know, who knows?
Maybe they gave it high marks because they're just glad to have unearthed something, you know, that was never out.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
But anyway, right. We love him for Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, of course. And we thought for this Christmas, we would marry the Masters with our third Stephen King cover or our third Stephen King movie mm-hmm. And cover Creepshow, which was directed by George Romero,
1982. Wow.
I forgot how many times I've seen this movie, but when I watched it, I was literally saying the dialogue with the characters.
I was too
that well yeah
I was too so obviously I've seen it, you know, quite a few times.
For those of you unfamiliar with it, it is an anthology film based on five Stephen King short stories, bookended with a crypt keeper type character from like the old Vault of Horror and Tales of the Crypt comics that you see behind me. There's the movie version of it. Anthology films don't traditionally do very well, and there are very few of them out there. I appreciate them. There's several I like, this probably being the favorite, though.
Yeah, there's several that I like, too. And this was like the age I've got in my notes. This was the age of anthologies, because you had Monsters Club and you had Heavy Metal before Creepshow. And then after it, you had like Twilight Zone, the movie Cat's Eye. Amazing Stories, Tales from the Crypt. I mean, everything came to television too, and it kind of resurged this short story form of movie making, which like a lot.
I do too. And I guess it's the American version, because I always associate the genre with the 70s and the British ones, like Asylum and Tales from the Crypt.
Right.
Those Hammer films. I think they were Hammer films that did the anthology format as well.
It's just a great way to see a short story told in a way. It's interesting that it hasn't crossed genres. We've seen, you know, amazing stories tried, I think, with Spielberg on television, but television's different. There's a difference between an anthology series, meaning it's going to be a different thing every week, to an anthology movie, meaning we have to cohesively put these short stories together, or short films together. But it's interesting that it hasn't crossed genres. I mean, why isn't there, like, you know, a romance anthology movie or a comedy anthology movie? Like, remember Kentucky Fried Movie, and there was another one that was a comedy kind of, and it was all short vignettes all thrown together, Python-esque sort of thing. But it's interesting that those haven't caught on either. I mean, you know,
it's funny. We talked about Monty Python last week and they did it.
Yeah.
But theirs were vignettes too. I think there's a difference in a vignette and a cohesive story.
Well, like History of the World was Mel Brooks's version of trying to, you know, throws these short little sketches together.
His attempt at Monty Python.
Yeah.
Doing like a broad subject with little vignettes for story. Yeah.
But it works perfect for horror because it's those little bits. You know, Asylum is a good example.
Yeah, I love that movie.
Is that the one that had the insane asylum with the razor wall?
It's on a Shutter right now. Any of you that have it, you can go watch it.
And it also had the Christmas, right? The Christmas Santa Claus is crazy.
That's Tales of the Crypt.
That's Tales of the Crypt. Okay.
Well, I mean, and unless there's another one, the one with Joan Collins and the killer Santa Claus is Tales of the Crypt.
The one I'm remembering, she kills her husband with a poker.
And he's in the body's in the basement or whatever.
Yeah. Then, but she doesn't know that Santa has escaped from an insane asylum.
Someone has escaped dressed as Santa. Yeah.
Dressed as Santa.
Exactly. Yeah. And the kid lets him in the house, I think. It's great. It's also the one, I think it's a Valentine's themed story with Peter Cushing. Comes back as like a zombie.
I just love it for horror because you just get to the scare and now, whew, we have a chance to and now we're on to a different story kind of thing. And I think this is a great example of it. I really enjoyed watching this again.
So much so
that I even watched part
of the sequel.
Something to Tide You Over, I watched a second time, you know, just to watch it again, just for the way it was shot. So.
You know, there are some bloopers from that I don't know where they're at because the DVD I had did not have them on it, but I have seen them somewhere, and it involves Ted Danson and Galen Ross as their zombie selves saying, "We're already dead." And one of them just looks at each other, the other one, and says, "I already said that." And they start laughing. I was like, where did I see that? I want to see it. So I went and I looked for the Blu-ray, and the Blu-ray doesn't have any extras on it either. I'm like, where have I seen that? I know I've seen it.
Well, I kept looking up because there, everywhere in my research, they kept talking about this incredible documentary called Just Desserts. And it's the making of Creepshow.
And I could
not find it anywhere for free. I found it on Amazon. You can order it.
Oh.
But I couldn't find it on any streaming service. I couldn't find it on any, even YouTube clips of it. There were a couple that were making of sections from it that I saw. Like one was a little 5-minute thing with Savini, which was really good. And one was another thing with Rubenstein. But there wasn't, you know, the normal, you could find that somewhere and just download it or even rent it or whatever. I could not nowhere. So I'm really curious to see it because it was really heavily touted. And I did find, speaking of which, you guys can find this on the YouTube. It is called Creepshow Behind the Scenes. And it is basically Tom Savini's assistant's handheld camcorder for an hour and 20 minutes. And it is all kinds of workshop stuff, like him taking a life cast of Stephen King, mm-hmm. you know, which was hilarious because sure. King was not really happy about
that. Oh, I'm sure, because it's like you're going to suffocate.
Yeah.
You just and got two little straws in your nose to breathe, and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. But almost all of it is his behind, you know, just handheld camcorder like we used to have, the big shoulder thing. Uh-huh. And him shooting Tom's workshop. So you're seeing him design Fluffy, and you're seeing them work on the animatronics, and seeing them design how are we going to squirt cockroaches. And it was really cool to watch that, but there's no structure to it all. No narration, no editing. It's just like, you know, like Bill Pitts filmed his workshop for an hour. You know?
Yeah, that's funny.
So, yeah.
Another thing that this movie has going for it, besides the writer and the director, is the mm-hmm. cast. I mean, it is a phenomenal mm-hmm. cast. A lot of these folks are famous now and weren't famous then.
Oh, yeah. Famous coming into it. Leslie Nielsen was really popular for his comedy and everything. And
I didn't look at the dates. Had Naked Gun come out yet?
Airplane had.
Okay. Because yeah. Naked Gun really shot him up as well. And then, of course, we know him from a little sci-fi movie called Forbidden Planet, mm-hmm. which is another movie we covered for you folks out there. Yes. George Romero, this was his first and only number one movie at the box office.
I wonder why, because we just said anthologies don't do that well. And
it must have been a slow weekend.
I mean...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I tried to do some research and find out, and there was something else that came out that was terrible. And I can't remember, but it came out around the same time. And in one of the interviews, I think it was Savini, said that maybe because that movie bombed, this one did well. So I didn't put it in my notes.
Well, I have a mean theory and a nice theory.
Yeah.
The mean theory is that this is the only movie he didn't write the screenplay for. So that could have a lot to do with it. The nice theory is that, well, most of his movies were indies and he didn't kowtow to the studio system. So not to be huge.
Yeah. And I like your pairing thought, you know, this was heavily touted as Stephen King and George Romero. Uh-huh. So you're pulling from both fan bases and it was unique. I mean, I remember seeing it for the first time going, okay, that is a comic book brought to life.
Right.
Before Marvel, before anything, this mm-hmm. is an EC comic brought to life, from the framing to the scotch angles to just the color washes.
The animation.
All of that was, yeah, it was great. Yeah. Loved mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody's really captured it since. I think Sam Raimi tried on Spider-Man 2. It was a little bit more, you know, full page spread going to an intense close up, going to, you know, kind of uh-huh. he tried to, but it didn't have the framing devices or the pullouts to the animation with the pages turning. I love that. I thought it was really cool.
The Spielberg shots where it's extreme close up and the background's getting further back or whatever.
Yeah. 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 All the transitions were really great. And, mm-hmm. Yeah. But I wonder, I'm glad it made money. I'm glad it did well for both of them.
It was the most, in my notes, I have that it was the most successful anthology movie ever.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Probably.
Because
more so than Twilight Zone.
Or those British ones I mentioned. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And Twilight Zone had a little bit of a history to it that kind of, I think, deterred people.
Well, yeah, we kind of had a huge lawsuit.
A big lawsuit, and an actor died while filming it, and it was highly publicized.
Two kids died, and
it had a bit of a black cloud over it. Otherwise, it would have had the Spielberg magic to surpass this, I would think.
But I agree with you. I think this movie had A lot of pedigree. It had the writer, it had the director, it had the special effects artist. And this was the first time Savini did all the special effects, not just the makeup. So he did the design work and the creature design as well. Mm-hmm. And the cast, it had a really strong cast all the way through it. I think Carrie Nye was great. I think the only one that's really like as far as the cast goes in the whole thing are probably in the first sequence, the son and daughter. They're probably the weakest in the cast.
It's
and
funny
they still
that
have
you
funny lines.
The son and daughter are, I mean, I went and looked at their resumes and they don't have hardly anything. And the daughter has absolutely nothing, I think, just this film. And the son is another Romero groupie. He was one of the bikers or no. Yeah, I think he was one of the bikers in Dawn of the Dead or something.
Okay.
Because some of these people are Romero people. And I didn't realize how much until I started digging deeper. Like Galen Ross being the woman that's in Something That Tied You Over. You barely even recognize her.
Oh, yeah. You don't. I mean, you only see her with wet hair in her face and as a
zombie with a lot of makeup on. And I'm like, that's the woman from Dawn of the Dead. I don't recognize her.
Right. Yeah. Right. But yeah, I mean, you know, the daughter has the one line about, I want him now or whatever. She just has terrible line readings. And the other guy is doing that, trying to do that pompous, spoiled nephew. Yeah. Anthony Marston.
That's a 10 Little Indians reference, a play that's that us great. And I were, I mean, David and I were in.
But yeah, that sort of character, yes. And that they're all in Father's Day. So I guess do we want to talk about the cast in general, or do we want to talk about each scene? And
well, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. How are we going to break this down? Because we're literally doing five little movies in one, not including the tag.
I think just take it in order and talk about each one, you know, what worked and everything else. I mean, I think that the bookends were clever, worked for me. I've got in my notes that kid looks like they found a baby Stephen King.
He is.
I mean,
that is him. That's Joe Hill.
That's I didn't know King. I didn't know that. Really?
Yes. He even talks like him. Yeah,
I know.
For those of you that didn't know, the little kid in the beginning that gets punished by his father for reading a horror comic book is Joe Hill King,
who went on to
now as Joseph Hill or Joe Hill, the writer who is fairly popular. He did the Nosferatu that we've talked about, the series that's on,
and he did Lock and Key, the comic book that then became, so that's kind of a key. He did a Lock and Key, which is a comic book that was turned into a Netflix series, which has now been renewed for a second season.
Yeah, he's a key to his father for sure, because he followed in his father's footsteps.
Definitely, definitely. And he's fairly decent in this.
He's great.
I like that he and his father both are the most overplayed in the entire film, but that works. You know, have another one, Daddy. You know,
would you like another shot?
Yeah.
And then he is also really sympathetic when he's like, "Please don't throw it away, Daddy."
Yeah, I mean, like, so, but he works. But yeah, from the minute I saw him, Billy, I think his name is Billy in it. I thought, okay, that's like a baby Stephen King, and so naturally, that works for me. It worked well. What do you have?
Oh, can't see that, can you?
Ooh, I can. Well, now I can't. Now,
you can't see it because of my background.
Well, yeah, but you could change your background into that. Yeah, there you go. Ooh.
That's the original.
That is
Creepshow
awesome.
Comic book from 1982. That's the
Kim actually
tie-in.
Has that in his paws right now. And it really is all the stuff from the each episode of the movie.
Yeah, and I was
now
wondering,
you gave stuff away. I saw frames that told the whole story. Yeah, but anyway,
I yanked that out of my closet. I have a bookcase in my closet to read before we did this. And then I was like, they had to have done this simultaneously or before, because some of these drawings by Bernie Wrightson look like the actors. Like, it looks like he's drawing Hal Holbrook.
Yeah. And they look like the frame pages that they're the transition frames.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You know.
Anyway, sorry to segue. So we have the wraparound where the father is mean, and the father is played by Tom Atkins, another, I guess you'd call him a B actor, but I like him a lot. He did a lot of Carpenter movies, The Fog and Halloween 3, to name a few.
A lot of policemen, a lot of
New York too.
The father figures. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He was a good standard B movie actor in the
70s. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then so the father throws the kid's comic book out, and the crypt keeper comes to the kid's window and I guess tells him these stories.
Yeah. It's a setup for, it's a prologue that sets up the credit roll, which is all animated, which is great and good, a good setup, and then kind of just dissolves into our first, you know, story, which was Father's Day. And although this, I think, is probably of all of them, it's the second weakest.
It's my favorite.
Is it really? Is it your favorite? Okay, tell me why. Why is it your favorite?
Because it's got a zombie coming out of a grave.
Well, yeah. It's got a zombie wanting cake.
Oh, my God. I love it. I absolutely love this episode. I love her drunken little monologue out at the grave, and then just how that hand shoots up out of the ground.
Oh, yeah.
That music. Ta-da! Ta-da! Ta-da!
Well, okay. Pause there for just a second. So two things. One, that was a key to me because that was Carrie. It was their version of Carrie, you know, right, with the arms. But music. So I wrote in my notes three different times, this music is very library. Where did they find this? This is very library music, especially in certain ones where they have even the whole theme going to it. But then in one of those little documentary snippets I watched, they had the guy who did the music, and he said originally George wanted to use library music for this.
Like he always has
in Night. And like he did in Dawn, mm-hmm. He said, but all of the music in this is original. Every piece of it. And I went, really? So now I've got to look, because I know there are two different themes in there that I've heard in something else. Well, so maybe it was in Day of the Dead or something else.
I mean, the jukebox at the beginning of the last story is playing the same song that we hear in The Evil Dead.
Yes.
So I recognize that music is not original to the movie.
No, but the thematic music.
Right.
So like, you know, and there's so much music in this. Music is really important in this storytelling.
I think it works
really well. Mm-hmm. I love the music in this. I love the thematics that he uses. I love the builds that he does. I love he'll go from these totally silent sequences to the bump, 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 mm-hmm. bump, you know, kind of stuff. Very Carpenter-esque kind of sound to it.
Right.
But yeah, it's really good music.
Back to Father's Day.
Yes.
You think it's the second weakest. Why do you, since I like it because it's got dead things in it, why do you like, what do you dislike it about? Just because it's cake?
No, it just didn't scare me as much as the other ones did.
Okay.
It part of it is the terrible, terrible, and this was actually this is my only real negative to the whole movie, is other than the dramatic lighting, the basic lighting is terrible in every scene. It's very Rubenstein to me. As a matter of fact, in my notes I wrote down, all of this is lit like Tales from the Dark Side. It's lit like television. Everything is bright, everything has, there's not a lot of shadows, there's not a lot of mood to the lighting, other than when he goes to the monochrome, like when she goes in the kitchen and it's all blue. That's really cool. You know, mm-hmm. the shot you've got behind you of when he rises from the crypt, he's red, but then as he claws toward her, he gets red on one side and blue on the other. Mm-hmm. And it's real stark and cool looking. Mm-hmm. But every other scene every other lighting in every other scene, even like Jordy in his house, it looks like a television set. It's way overlit. It's very bright. And I just don't like the lighting in a lot of it. But I guess my big my big detraction from the first one is I just, in comparison, I do like the way the story works and builds suspense. It just doesn't scare me as much as like The Crate did, or Something to Tide You Over, which I thought was just kind of really creepy all the way through. E.G. Marshall one is just doesn't scare me because I'm not afraid of bugs, but I'm sure people who are afraid of bugs really don't like that.
Oh, episode. I have a story about that one.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. When we get to it, I'll tell it. But as far as this, we could mention the cast. I mean, Ed Harris is in it.
Although that is another reason not to like this episode, is that is some of the worst dancing I've ever seen.
It's hilarious. And he's so hilarious. Young. And it made me go, wait a minute, he's in another Romero movie, Knight Riders, which made me want to watch Knight Riders again because I haven't seen it in forever.
I haven't either. I'd love to see that again. That was if anybody out there, if you have a chance to see Knight Riders, not the silly remake 90s thing, but the one that George Romero did with Ed Harris as essentially a modern King Arthur.
It's King Arthur on motorcycles.
Savini's in it.
Yeah, Savini's in it too.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
It's a good little Romero movie. And I had forgotten about it until I saw Ed Harris in this movie.
Uh-huh.
And Ed Harris, you know, I don't know if he's ever won an Academy Award. He's certainly been nominated for them. He's a huge actor now. He's on a show you love, Westworld.
Westworld, yes.
Anyway, he is in this story, and he meets his fate in what I thought was rather well-lit graveyard with the fog and everything. So I don't know. Maybe it wasn't well-lit.
Well, I also have his death doesn't make sense to me because the rest of them, it's a vengeance story. Why would he take vengeance? Why would Grantham take vengeance on this new kid who never knew anything?
I don't know. It's comic book logic. It doesn't really have to have it. He also, what's he do? Summon the grave to fall on him because he's standing in front of the tombstone.
Yeah, that was kind of weird. But
he's kind of like got his hands out, but all of a sudden the grave's about to, you know, topple onto.
Right. And it's like, I'll just lay here and see what's going to happen with this grave that's right above me.
I would have been
jumping up out of it. Yeah. Screw the cigarettes. I'm gone.
You also have a very convenient corpse rollover. He basically touches her hand and she rolls over.
Yeah. But
I don't know. It all works for me, though. And I love the fact that all he says basically is, it's Father's Day. I want my
cake, Bedelia. I did like the gurgle on his voice. That was really cool.
Yeah.
I like the design. That was good creature work, I think. And really, you know, a key for me was that's very Return of the Living Dead kind of corpsey. I think is probably a precursor to Tarman or whatever. To have that kind of skeletal, more zombie moving.
He's
everything.
A little heavy, though. You could tell his skull's oversized. It. Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't go for the, you know, the really skinny actor to make it work.
No.
But I've got great jump scare with a hand, great backstory. I love the backstory. It is a very EC backstory. So it is a good start.
Uh-huh.
Because they tell the whole history of this is what she did to her father. Even though she looks exactly the same age. I mean, how long That's ago true. Was this? But... but you know, it's a very EC story of you were so cruel that, you know, we had to take it in our own hands and now you came back sort of thing.
And she murders him with a marble ashtray that appears in every episode of this movie.
And I didn't realize that until it was like, I guess in The Crate when I saw it again and went, wait, is it in everything?
Yeah. And it, what I understand, it's even in the teaser and tag. It's like on the little kid's desk or something. I read that somewhere. I didn't look for it, but anyway, yeah, I knew because I remembered it being in a soap, being a soap dish at one time too. All right. So if we don't have anything more about Father's Day, we can move on to the second segment. I'm just making sure I don't have something about, if we do, we'll get back to it. I don't think I do. The second segment stars none other than Stephen King himself. making his acting debut. I think he's done what, one movie other than cameos, and it was this.
No, he did. Wasn't he fairly a lot bigger in Maximum Overdrive? Wasn't he a preacher in that or something?
Well, he directed that. He if he
but
did,
I thought
it,
he was in it as well. Oh, okay, maybe it wasn't just a cameo.
Yeah, he's been a cameo in a lot of movies. He's probably got Hitchcock beat on that. But as far as acting, I thought he did a great job.
Well, I like the fact that they tailor the whole scene to him, you know, to that style. The doctor is just as melodramatic, you know, so everyone's a little over, but meteor shit, you know, he's just big eyed and everything.
Yeah. And I'm putting it in the show notes. I remember the trailer from this on TV, and they always showed that scene with him taking his finger down the, meat cleaver. This is going to be extremely painful.
Now this one literally was based on a short story, right? Was Father's Day on a short story, or was it original to Creepshow? Because I remember reading this was called had a this one had a different title. I remember
it was called Weeds.
Oh, okay.
And I think it was published in Cavalier magazine. King was notorious for publishing in porno rags in the 70s, like Gallery and Cavalier. And I think this was a story called Weeds that was in one of those magazines. And then I'm not sure it was ever reprinted. I don't think he's collected it in any of his books.
I don't know.
Could be wrong. Let me know if I am out there.
I liked the structure of this one. I've got in my notes, this has to be library music twice. So that's how effective it was.
The music in this does sound very, very public domain. I thought when I heard it, I was like, oh yeah, this is Romero just using cheap music.
I thought the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and King is basically, other than the Dr. King, is the only actor in this piece.
Yeah, he carries it.
You know, he carries the whole thing. I like the, the lighting again is kind of too big, but I love the weeds. I love the green, how green everything is.
A lot of green lighting.
And the progression and how it grows and all that kind of thing. I like the time-lapse cuts that they do where they'll show like the knob on the television has a little green, and then all of a sudden we'll get a lap dissolve and it'll be a different program on television. Now the green is all the way over onto the screen and tendrils and little bristles or whatever. I did not like his beard. I thought that was a bad design. They should have made it less look like a green beard. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was that same premise of get the blood out of their eyes.
Yeah, get the blood out of their eyes. Keep it away from his eyes and his mouth. Yeah. Because I also read, you know, a backstory kind of production thing that he was allergic to the makeup.
Yeah, he broke out.
And had to take like Benadryl and
they
stuff.
They put him on something because he was having some bad reactions from what I read too.
But yeah, I love the fact that, you know, it's a very King thing to me that when he sits down, he's drinking from a literal bottle of Ripple. It says Ripple. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, because at one time he gets Popoff vodka out of his thing and he mixes it.
He gets Popoff with the orange juice.
Yeah.
And I remember us watching, it came back to me. I remember us watching it together or something. And it was either Bill Pitts or somebody's. Said to somebody else, I've seen you drink screwdrivers like that, you know, where you just pour it into the thing and stir it up with the bottle.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
His house is a disaster. He just throws it on the floor. There's shit everywhere.
Yeah. But that's, you know, the lonesome farmer kind of vibe anyway. So that works. The story I thought, you know, progressed really well. I mean, it was a setup from the beginning. We knew what was going to happen. It's the first few minutes.
Yeah, it's an homage to a Lovecraft story, The Color Out of Space.
And also think it had a lot of keys with the blob. very The Blob kind of feel to it.
Oh, yeah, you know, especially.
Cracking open the meteor, touching the meteor, you know. Mm-hmm. If a meteor lands in your backyard, don't reach out near it at all. Yeah. No.
Leave it alone.
Yeah. And Tommyknockers, it has a lot of Tommyknocker feel to it, although it's not a malevolent alien. It's just a growing weed.
Well, and in Tommyknockers, he uncovers it already buried in the ground, whereas in this one, it lands. Yeah.
True.
And it's a she. Bobby Anderson's her name.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe I remember that.
Wow. Dang.
I know. That was an obscure book.
It was.
So the only other actor in this movie, and I have these actors, but I don't have a lot on them. I have, when I do, I will say something. But I can't remember the actor that plays his father and the doctor, but it's the same guy. And you only see him in like flashbacks or dream sequences.
Right.
So like you said, Stephen King carries this piece other than those sequences.
And all of the references to the doctor are done with cool framing, the comic book framing or weird Scotch angle close-ups.
In a mirror.
Or just little stuff like him, King getting scared, and you just see the skeleton in the chair just behind him for no reason. It's just going.
It's George across having the frame. Fun. It's what it is. Yeah. And actually, I wanted to ask you, in that scene where he's in the bathroom and sees his dad in the mirror, I think that's practical. I think he was really standing there, and they did that with lighting. I don't know. What do you think? Man, it didn't look like special effects to me.
I thought it looked green screen to me, but it might have been practical.
Did they
have green screen
back then? I guess they did. I don't know.
Well, he could have mirror angled it too. So he could have been just standing right off and they angle the mirror in a way that
it
shows him.
Yeah, it looked to me like just a lighting change.
Okay, I may have to look at that again. It might have been just a lighting change, which would have been great.
This movie came... I was still in high school when this movie came out.
Yeah, there's your age. There you go.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't have any more on that one. I guess we can move to the third one, which is the one you said you watched twice. Why did you watch this one twice?
I really liked this one, and I remembered it again as being my favorite, even when I saw it the first few times I saw it. I love this to me is a great vengeance story, which is what EC Comics always were to me. The ones that that imprinted on me weren't supernatural so much as they were supernatural precipitated by some kind of vengeance. We're thrown in medias res, as you say, or whatever, into this story, which I like too. It's a very intimate, small cast that their stories within a few lines of dialogue. It's also not as overplayed as all of the rest of them are. It's probably the most, I think, realistic performances in this.
I would say even, that the crate's pretty realistic in places, too.
Well, but they intentionally overplay that too. I mean, like Adrienne Barbeau is way out there.
She
in
is
her performance.
She is so over the top. But Hal Holbrook is not, and neither is Dexter Stanley.
Well, and Fritz Weaver's character, even when he becomes hysterical, is still realistic hysteria, which is hard to play. Mm-hmm. And Fritz Weaver is a great actor to do that. That worked. Really
I guess
well.
He got his chance.
Because he got his chance. And he's like laughing. That dark humor you get when you're totally hysterical.
Before you proceed, we forgot. We said the first one was Father's Day. The one we covered with Stephen King was called The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill. And this one is called Something to Tide You Over.
Mm-hmm. But I really like Leslie Nielsen in this. I like the fact that this is a comic actor playing a real dick. But he enjoys it all. He is, his interpretation of stuff about blip, 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 blah, 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 you know, and the,
yeah, he, well, I love when he's doing his little dance and stuff, and it's like you're killing these two people and you're enjoying it way too much.
Well, and like the picture you've got over your shoulder, he's, I love the fact that he just lays down beside him, buried there, and he's telling him about it, and then he's looking at us, oh, the tide is coming in. Yep. Yep. Well, I gotta go. You know, yeah, it's a great vengeance story. I've always liked the it's actually a Hitchcockian kind of thing, and probably dates back longer than that, but the whole older husband getting revenge on the new guy who's trying to steal my wife. Mm-hmm. You know, that's basically, this is the plot I've got it in my notes. What's the murder mystery with only two people in it? It's very popular. Everybody does it. Sleuth. You know, this is Sleuth. This is the old smart guy thinking he's getting revenge on the young lover of his wife, and oops, flips on him at the end.
Well, it's Death Trap to an extent too.
Yeah. Same story. Yep.
Yeah.
An old mystery chestnut, as they say, and it worked really well for me. I love some of the lines. I've got all these lines of, come on, you don't want Becky to miss her knight in shining corduroy, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. We're slacking a bit on telling the plots. I just realized, this one, he basically catches or finds out that he's being cheated on with Ted. His wife is cheating with Ted Danson. So he buries her down the beach, puts a video monitor on him, on her, and then buries Ted Danson and puts a video monitor or puts a television in front of him so he can see
her suffer.
Yes. Yeah. See her suffer as right before he dies himself. And then they come back as zombies and get him.
You're a zombie.
It's another Jim reason says. I like it.
Yes, they do come back as zombies. Yes.
You mentioned Leslie Nielsen's in it. I mean, he's been around forever. He was in Forbidden Planet. He did, I want to say, some romantic movies in the 50s, like Tammy and the Bachelor, maybe. And and then he went on to comedy fame with Airplane and The Naked Gun. But another comedic actor that happens to be in this is the guy buried right there, Ted Danson. Mm-hmm. Young Ted Danson with brown hair, not white, who was, I'm assuming, on Cheers at the time.
Probably.
When did Cheers start?
It would probably be 81, I would think.
Yeah, because this was 82. This was probably...
You know, another reason why people may have come to see it. You know,
well, I knew who he was at the time. So
okay.
I must have seen him on there. I had to have. And then, of course, we mentioned Galen Ross plays his lover and Leslie Nielsen's wife. She is Fran from Dawn of the Dead.
And I like Leslie Nielsen is he's a techno geek in this. He's always talking about the equipment and taking care of your equipment. You know, there's a top load VCR within the first like 2 minutes of this,
and a lot of tapes.
This episode. Yeah, yeah. Lots of tapes. He's very voyeuristic, obviously, which is there. But I hate this TV lighting, and boy, this music sounds like library music again in my notes. So, Leslie Nielsen gets out of the shower and his hair is perfect. It is just still.
Well, I noticed when he was in the shower, he wasn't letting it get wet. I was like, that's what my mother would do.
I know. I did like the creature design. I like Savini's design for both of them, the very waterlogged look and all the seaweed, and you don't see their eyes, which I thought was great. Mm-hmm. I liked that whole sequence, the way they build that suspense with the fog moving up to the door, but we're not seeing it. We're seeing it through the camera lens, not through through his closed circuit television lens, not practical.
Attention, so everything Bodega Bay, stay away from the fog.
Stay away from the fog.
Oh, we'll get to you, Billy, in a moment.
Very Savini in the fact that he shoots both of them right in the head. It's a very Dawn of the Dead kind of key for me because I'm, but because of the lighting, the blood doesn't look red. You know, it looks
like
blue.
Soy sauce.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's nasty.
I really like that. That was great. Yeah. And it was just, I just like the whole story of this one.
Okay.
The next one, however, is probably second best, right? Or is that your second best? The crate? Is that, that's what you like the second best?
Ooh, yeah. You know, the crate's going to be up there, though. It may be higher than this. I think that Father's Day may be my first, and then the crate, and then this. But I don't have anything else on this as far as cast, which I guess we could move on. I am missing a little bit on cast, but we'll return to them when we recap at the end.
Okay.
So that would bring us to our next installment, which
again, this one was based on a short story, correct?
It was. This was a short story entitled the same, The Crate.
And it was like in something I read. So it was because I remember reading it. So it was like in Night Shift or something.
No. I know he published it in a magazine. Are you sure you're not? It could have been in Skeleton Crew, but I don't think it is. Skeleton Crew would have been the one.
I think I remember seeing it, reading it. I just don't remember in what.
Yeah, we're just going to have to wiki it.
Skeleton Crew. Maybe Skeleton. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll have to wiki and look.
For some reason, it reminds me of the monkey. I guess because it looks kind of like a monkey. The monkey with the symbols, you know, he did a story. I think it's called The Monkey, about one of those toys where the monkey claps the symbols together.
Oh, yeah, with the symbols.
And that is in Skeleton Crew for sure. Anyway, this story is about two college professors that are old friends that like to play chess once a week. One of them is sort of dabbles with the younger ladies. The other is married to a, quote, shrew, I guess, for a lack of better words.
Yeah. Good way to put it. Yeah.
It starts with a janitor who flips a coin that rolls under a grate under the stairs. He finds an old crate dated 1800s from Arctic expedition. He calls the single professor who comes out to investigate. They open it. The janitor gets murdered, and then another student gets murdered when he tries to help. And then Dexter Stanley, who is the professor, runs frantically to his friend. I can't think of his name, played by Hal Holbrook. I can't think of the character's name. Hysterical, as you said, telling him that there's this monster in a crate that's just killed two people. And what does Hal Holbrook do instead of, you know, assisting him? He basically gives him some drugs, knocks him out, goes and cleans up the mess, and then coaxes his wife to come out so that he can have her get eaten too. And then, of course, after that happens, he takes the crate out to a quarry and he locks it again, keep with the creature and whatever people he's eaten in it, and throws it over the ledge, and then goes back and tells his friend, ask him to please not report him to the police, and that they can continue playing chess weekly for the rest of their lives. So that's another kind of vengeance story, I guess you would say.
Yeah, a variation on the vengeance story, which I think was, you know, with that kind of, I don't want to say tongue in cheek, because I don't think this is really played for laughs. I do think it's played for some really good scares, but that kind of, what would you do in that situation? Who's the protagonist? You kind of say, yeah, why
there's
wouldn't
definitely
you?
Some stuff played for laughs in this one. The good shot.
Oh, well, yeah, but that's a fantasy. So yeah, just tell it to call you Billy.
Just tell it to call it Billy, you bitch. Yeah. All the catchphrases that came out of this movie.
I remember this inspired me. I wanted to be a horny college professor after watching this. I was going, why wouldn't you want to be that? You know, it works for Dexter.
And who wouldn't want to be Fritz Lieber? He's so cool. He's
so cool and everything.
Or, I said Fritz Lieber. I meant Fritz Weaver. Fritz Lieber's the writer. Fritz Weaver's the actor. He's great. Everybody, to me, this is the best cast segment of all of them.
Yeah, I would agree. I think even down to the janitor and the kid, all the casting is really strong in this. I've got in my notes, okay, I'm over this lighting. Why would you even use a flashlight? This is the brightest basement in the whole world.
You know, it is a bright basement.
It is. It is. Creature design is great in this. The plot overall works really well. Great hysteria, great performances. Charlie's death, I have great creature design with Fluffy because it is kind of this weird gorilla albino monster thing with lots of teeth, and it works. And I've got Charlie's death is really, really gruesome, more gruesome than I remember.
Well, they do in red lighting, so you see less of it.
Right, but I mean, literally gets, it's like that. My key for it is, you know, that first bite in Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
That's what it reminds me of. It's like his shoulder, but
it's his neck and his shoulder. You see the teeth marks of each individual tooth. It is. Savini, he's just great at it, you know.
And when when Fluffy scratches its face, you see the rips. I mean, through his eye and everything. I was like, that's gruesome.
Yeah, it's almost as good as Basket Case.
No.
When the same thing happens.
Oh my gosh.
Same year. Same exact year.
Yeah, but we know who's the cinematic makeup genius and who's not, though.
Right,
I mean, come on.
Right.
I've gotten my notes. I love the fact that in all of these, they use the gobo effect, you know, where suddenly it's a close-up, but the background changes and has like a weird gobo shadow thing in it or with design. Bright color.
Yeah, like a zigzag or something very comic book looking. You mentioned the creature design. Savini, as good as he is with these effects that gross us out, had never done an animatronic. And I read that he was on the phone with Rob Bottin for an hour and a half asking him questions. And of course, Rob Bottin, the very same year, did The Thing.
The Thing.
And he had previously done The Howling, I think. So he was already well known. So that's who Savini turned to create Fluffy, as she was affectionately known as, the creature.
And they tried in this one, at least this one has a little bit more, they try with lighting. Like, look at that shot you've got behind you of Hal Holbrook. That one, you know, has some mood to it, as opposed to, oh, I can see every hair on his head sort of, you know, in bright light sort of thing, like Ted Danson was lit. So, but I wanted to ask you what you thought about the way they did the ending of this, because I love the fact that we're going from first person POV of him and mopping up everything.
Excuse me.
Then we go to like this voiceover of of simultaneous action, because she finds the letter that he left her and you hear his voiceover. So she's going to where he is. He's trying to, and you're feeling that Hitchcockian suspense of get it cleaned up in time before she gets there.
Exactly.
You know, but then once she finally dies, we go to suddenly all this voiceover and it's all a flashback of him telling Dexter what happened next. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really clever storytelling idea.
Yeah. It was like a box within a box, like a comic book.
Yeah, and very comic book, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it's just, so are we going to sit down and play chess, you know?
Sort of thing. I expect to whip your ass in chess twice a week for the rest of our lives or whatever. Yeah, that's like one of the final
And he lines. Does like his first move and goes, I didn't see anything. And it's just that pausing and everything. Mm-hmm. You go, yeah, that was really cool.
Well, and I mean, what makes it work is Hal Holbrook and Fritz Weaver. They're excellent actors.
They're excellent.
So good. Yes. And even playing off the crazy over the topness of Adrienne Barbeau. And Adrienne Barbeau is a great actress too. She was told to play it that crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you see her in The Fog, you'll know what I mean, because I just rewatched that one recently. And she's great.
I want to see that again. Yeah. Man.
Yeah, it's a good old ghost story.
But it is.
But yeah, all that stuff in the beginning with her was she's like, they're at the afternoon occasion and she's drinking. And then apparently they go home and she has a meeting and she's still drinking. And then she comes home and pours milk into her drink. And you're like, what the fuck are you drinking?
Well,
she drives across town to the university, gets out of the car, and she's got the drink in her hand. The glass of milk still with the booze in it.
And I actually remember looking that up like the second or third time I watched this on VHS or whatever, because I always noticed it and thought that is just so weird, but found out that's an old alcoholic trick of you pour your scotch or your whiskey into milk and it helps you digest it easier. It helps your stomach not be as upset. And I thought that's kind of interesting. So it helps prevent ulcers and things. For you alcoholics out there that don't do that, here's a tip. And I've got it. My last note on this one is I love the catchphrase, what are friends for? Mm-hmm. Because that was really cool. That was kind of like Dexter's first line to him in the beginning at the party. But yeah, it's a good story. Well told.
Yeah, I think so too. Mm-hmm. As far as if I have any casting notes, I thought this is one of four films that Adrian Barbeau starred in with Tom Atkins, the guy from the wraparound at the beginning that we talked about.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. Wait, they're in The Fog, right?
They're in The Fog. They are in Escape from New York. Oh. And they are in Two Evil Eyes, which is a Dario Argento, George Romero collaboration anthology film. Mm-hmm. And they're in this, which is another anthology film, George Romero. Hmm. So I love the fact that all the movies that they were in were like Romero or Argento or Carpenter. I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah.
The big masters of the 80s horror. I mean, come
right,
on.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And then I don't have anything on, Fritz Weaver or what's his face?
Hal Holbrook.
But we know they're great. I mean, Hal Holbrook has been around forever. He was married to Dixie Carter, who I loved from Designing Women. He's just brilliant old actor. School. Yeah. Is he really
both
Southern?
Movie and television? He did a lot and theater. Did a lot of theater.
Yeah, he played Mark Twain, didn't he? In theater.
Yeah, well, he would take that on tour periodically and do a one-man show of Mark Twain. Yeah, and was very good at it. Yeah.
And I think he is Southern. I can't. If he's not, he should be. He just seems Southern to me.
I don't know if he is or not.
I don't either. Know. I don't either.
But yeah, it was probably, I mean, I think a lot of people think this is the best piece in it. I think it clocks in as the longest piece. Which probably works, you know, to that advantage too. I know that the people, like a couple of the interviews I saw, one was with Adrian Barbeau, and she said it was considered like the centerpiece, the main story of the entire movie, sort of thing.
Yeah, so, and actually in the comic, it's flipped. This comes before Something to Tide You Over. For some reason, they flipped it in the movie. I don't know why.
Yeah. Hal Holbrook was born in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh.
So he's technically a Yankee.
He is a Yankee. Okay. Well, I'll be down.
There's that. There you go.
All right.
Thank you, Google.
Moving on, we will go to the fifth and final entry into this anthology series, and that is called They're Creeping Up on You. I have a bit of a story on this one.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this movie for the first time at the Princess Theater in Morristown. And I don't know if you remember this or not, but it was opening weekend. And if a movie was in process and people were there for the next showing of the movie, there would be a large crowd in the lobby waiting for the movie to get over before you could go in.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, an old theater. So it was not like there was a big lobby. So there's just a lot of people in this lobby at the Princess Theater. And we could hear screaming and laughter and just people just this huge ruckus during this last segment. So we all are going in wondering what happens near the end of this movie that makes these people scream and laugh and carry on so much.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the fact that there are all these bugs in this particular installment. And this is another one of those that's carried pretty much by one actor.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only other, there's voice actors in it, but basically he does it. We get to see the back of his head, the side of his head, and the lips of the janitor, but that's it.
Yeah, the super, Mr. White.
Yeah. I looked it up, actually, that if you are an entomophobic, you probably hate this movie. I mean, this particular scene or episode or short, because it doesn't skimp at all on being afraid of cockroaches.
Romero also preached that it was the most expensive part of the movie, that each one of those cockroaches cost 50 cents and there were like, you know, 100,000 of them or something.
Yes. Savini said that in his interview too. He said it was the most expensive part of the movie was the cockroaches, and that he is horribly afraid of cockroaches and was never on a scene with them. He would direct from another room. Beyond glass, he said, I would direct the special effects like Mr. White. I would be like, okay, blood go, roaches go, and don't bring them near me at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, there were 10,000 of, no, 18,000 is what I have in my notes. They originally got 10,000 from Trinidad, and they bred 8,000 while they were shooting it in the Roach Motel.
To synopsize this, basically you've got a germaphobe that lives in a high-rise apartment that is obsessed because he keeps seeing the occasional cockroach. He is a ruthless businessman that is supposedly responsible for one of his employees committing suicide. He treats people like shit. He's a racist. And all of this comes to the light of day throughout the progress of the story, with him in telephone calls and I guess voice flashbacks, would you say? I don't know what you would say that, how you would say that. Anyway, I have a question though. All right, basically what happens is he does in the, and no one believes him. They think he's crazy and he ends up dying in the end, but then all of a sudden his dead body is there and there's no bugs. And then his body burst open and hundreds of thousands of cockroaches come out of his body. So yeah. How do you interpret that? I don't really know. Yeah. There's not a lot of logic.
No. Oh no, there's not. This one makes no real.
Was it in his head? No, it's actually in his body.
Right. It wasn't his imagination, which if they had reversed that, if they had done the whole blah, 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 and it crawls out of his chest and mouth and eyes and everything and yada, yada, and then gone to the janitor trying to get a hold of him and they're just pulling back and there's nothing there. It's just his body. It would have worked for me because I would have thought, oh, it was all in his head. Mm-hmm. But
they wanted that last jump scare.
They want that last jump scare and that ickiness and that huge effect of it, even though it's a terrible dummy. But the effect is still really cool. But it makes no sense. I don't know why the bugs are doing it, how they got in, what they did, what happened.
See, I chalked it up to the same logic I did Father's Day. I was like, okay, it's just comic book logic.
It's just comic book. Man, why the hell?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's some EC comics out there that don't make sense.
Yeah. It's the fate will win at the end. You know, you will get your just desserts sort of thing, which is why I think that title for the documentary is kind of cool, but you will get your just desserts one way or the other. And in this one, no matter how he tries, no matter how much money, bug spray, whatever he throws, he can't fight, you know, put off his worst fear. Sort of thing. And he's portrayed as such a Scrooge type horrible, evil man that, you know, you can
prick.
You can only laugh at what he gets. You know, him hitting the buttons going, talk to me, talk to me, talk to
talk
me.
Talk to me,
Yeah.
Funny that we're talking about how horrible he is and how great he is at the part.
Oh, yeah.
And he's played by E.G. Marshall, an actor that's been around forever. But believe it or not, there was another person rumored to that was originally slated to play this part, but could not. And do you want to know who it is? And it's going to knock your socks off.
My socks are ready.
Max von Sydow.
Wow.
But you know why he couldn't?
No. Why?
Because he was filming Dune. Yeah.
Oh my God. I did not know that, but
a movie we covered just a few episodes back.
Sad that because I would love to have seen him in this. That would have been really cool.
I can't see him being as much of an ass as this guy. He seems
well. E.G. Marshall, you could tell, just loved being. I mean, that's a good picture you have behind you. He just loved being mean. You could tell. Like when he's going, Mrs. Katzen, Mrs. Katzenjammer. Mrs. Katzen, you know? Oh, and he's so, grinning he's, the whole time.
Oh, and he's so racist to Mr. White, the black superintendent.
Oh yeah, your people.
Yeah. People of color.
People of like, color.
Dick.
And even when he's, you know, calling the police department, he thinks, you know, you don't know who you're talking to. You know, this is Upton Pratt and all that. And he's the just Upton that.
Pratt.
Yeah. So he got his, you know, just reward kind of thing at the end.
I always liked it when he was like eating whatever that shit was in
his cereal
food processor. And then he was like, This doesn't look right. And he pours that cereal out and all them cockroaches just come flying out of that box.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So sick, man.
Yeah, it was. And they had, you know, to be fair, they did have entomologists who actually, you know, got the cockroaches, brought them to Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, and, you know, shot with them all. Although I did hear in research that they had to exterminate them all at the end, because they couldn't get rid of him any other way. So they had to exterminate all the cockroaches.
Wow. That sounds like they couldn't do that nowadays. But
Because they were imported. So you couldn't leave them in the country. And they didn't want to pay to ship them back to Trinidad.
Wow.
To the caves with the bat guano and everything. So, yeah, they had to exterminate.
Yeah, there's some gnarly looking cockroaches. Some of them are gigantic.
In the... And I also read a little thing because I was listening to a podcast that just had an interview with Savini, and he said they actually had nicknames for them. The biggest ones, which were almost 2.5 inches long, the big, you know, Trinidad cockroaches, all the entomologists and everybody called them Steves. And then the medium sized one, they called Richards for Rubenstein, and the small ones they called Georges. So they would, you know, George would be able to say, hey, I need 10,000 Steves over here with 50 Georges, you know, sort of thing. And in that YouTube thing you can find with the makeup, he also goes to the Roach Motel. So you can see, I mean, these like 50-gallon drums with these tubes coming out of them that have seals on them. But you open it up and it's just cardboard and crawling with cockroaches. I mean, just thousands of them in each drum, and they've got like 15 or 20 of these drums, you know, because they would use vacuums to suck them up in between shots, and then they would squirt them all back out, and then they would, you know, and they're all handling them and being, I was like, man, if I didn't like insects, this would freak me out.
I don't think I put it in my notes, but they were doubtful about it at first, and they had a backup story if they had to substitute. Because they weren't
sure they couldn't
be able to film it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it works, you know, and I think it's a great lead in. I love the transition out of this with that pull away shot, and then it goes to the cartoon version, and suddenly it's flipping in the wind, and we realize that we're back to the bookend sort.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
And you're you've got two garbage men, one played by Tom Savini.
Tom Savini, yeah.
And I believe the other one was another Dawn of the Dead vet. One of the guys played the security guard in Dawn of the Dead. One of them was a biker. I can't remember which, but they were both small character actors in this. And Savini makes note that a little piece is cut out of the comic book where someone's ordered a voodoo doll. And that's when we discover that the kid whose father threw out his comic book at the beginning has a voodoo doll, and he's now torturing his father. Yes. Sticking pins into it. Have another shot, Dad.
Dad. And then it goes to the still store frame, comes out with comic book again. I mean, it's really good. I mean, it's just a nice little capper.
Yeah, it is. Everything works in this movie to me. I mean, for what it is, I'm not saying it's a perfect movie. It's definitely not on the 1001 you must see before you die, but it is a great anthology movie by two masters of their worlds, writing and horror.
Yeah. It was, I do think it should be on the 1000 because I think it's a great example of the, you know, of this combined horror geniuses.
Yeah.
A great anthology and one of the best comic books put on film ever, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. I backtracking just a bit to casting, I neglected to say something about Father's Day. Nathan Grantham was played by John Lormer of Star Trek.
Yep.
He played Old Man Tamar and Dr. Theodore Haskins in For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky.
Yep.
Thought that you would find that interesting. This movie did not win any awards, but it was nominated for Saturn Awards for Best Horror Film and Best Poster Art. That poster is right there.
Yep. Yep. It did gross. Like you said, it was a very popular movie, I think.
Do you remember the tagline?
No, I don't.
The most fun you'll ever have being scared.
Being scared. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. I do have some trivias. I've got some of them we talked about, the allergic reaction and the cockroaches being most expensive, first animatronic. But the two that I didn't have was Warner Brothers really didn't have faith in the movie at all. Until after the first weekend. And then they tried to dump a bunch of advertising in it at the last minute. And I have that King was superstitious and carried a little Star Wars figurine of Guido in his pocket.
I read that
in all of his scenes. So I thought that was interesting.
That's a very strange thing to do. This was very when strange. He was drinking and drugging a lot. So. I don't think I have any other trivia. I do have another overlap that's not really a key, though. Adrian Barbeau was still married to John Carpenter when Creepshow was released. Hal Holbrook and Tom Atkins both starred in this film, also co-starred with her in The Fog, which Carpenter directed. There's a lot of connection here with Carpenter, Romero, and these actors. And I love that. I just think that's so cool.
Well, and key-wise, there's a lot of connection going forward to the remake of this and everything else that came out of it.
Right. Well, and from what I understand, I think Greg Nicotero, this was his first film, and he was like a kid almost, like a teenager.
Well, he had worked with him on, Savini had actually hired him for Day of the Dead.
But that was 85. This is 82.
Yeah, I don't think Nicotero worked on this one. I don't think he worked on this one.
Maybe it was this one that just inspired him.
Yeah.
He mentions this movie fondly, for sure.
Yes, and loved it. And it was the reason that he's producing the remake, you know, or the new version.
The new series on Shudder. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, because I have that this inspired Nicotero. He was hired then by Tom Savini at the age of 14 to do Day of the Dead.
Right. And oh, that's his head on the gurney in Day of the Dead. I don't know if people know that.
I did not know
A model of his head that they have that's alive with the electrodes attached to it. And he went on to form his own special effects company, K&B, which is huge.
Well, yeah, right now, huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Walking Dead and everything else. But yes.
Yeah. And well, and he basically is one of the biggest producers, I guess, on Walking Dead, too.
Yep.
So, yeah, this movie inspired Greg Nicotero. I could probably put him down as a key.
Well, and the reason I was saying it was kind of not incestuous, but there's all these ties and links. Mm-hmm. In the first season of Creepshow, he actually hired Tom Savini to direct an episode.
Yeah, because Savini does direct. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this interview that this podcast interview I listened to with Savini, he said he really doesn't do makeup effects anymore at all or special effects. He still teaches in Pittsburgh, but he is basically doing more into directing and assistant directing on projects and that sort of thing, advising more than anything else. So I thought that was interesting. Keys. And while we're talking, the remake. So there is a remake or a new series, I guess, of this?
Well, yeah, it is actually called Creepshow. Yes.
And did you tell me to watch? And I watched a couple, and they were actually good.
Yeah,
is it Creepshow?
It's Creepshow.
It had the Evil Dead.
You watched, I think, or directed by Nicotero. You watched the one that was the public television of the Evil Dead or whatever. Yeah, of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
It's great. And then you watched the one with the kid and the Aurora Monster models.
The Aurora Monster models come to life. Yeah,
and I told you there's one you need to watch that's even better, where he goes back into actual films, and one of them is Horror Express, Christopher Lee movie.
Okay,
and the special effects are great. They're in the movie. It's just weird. So that's a good one too. That show, and I said this, I think, on the Hereditary episode, because I was listening to it the other day. It's about a 75-25% ratio, good bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, not all of them are great, but I mean, all of these shows are that way. Another show this movie inspired was Tales of the Crypt, which ran on HBO for like a decade, I think, a long time. And well, not all of those were good.
And Tales from the Dark Side. This was very Tales from the Dark Side. You know, I think it inspired that.
And that actually was Rubenstein who produced this. He produced that as well, because that was Romero's buddy. But I don't know who did Tales of the Crypt. Kevin Yeager did the creature design. I remember that. Kevin Yeager is known for doing Freddy Krueger in the latter stages of his development, like after the first film. Other anthologies. I mean, there's a ton of them. So basically you can say Creepshow, Tales of the Crypt, Tales of the Dark Side, those kind of shows were all inspired by this. Tales of the Dark Side may have actually been out before this. I can't remember.
No, I'm pretty sure it came out after.
Okay. Well, to go back further, I mean, the comic books themselves, Tales of the Crypt, Vault of Horror, all the EC comics are what Stephen King remembered reading as a kid, and that's how this movie came to be, or we wouldn't have it. So that's probably the original key, or unless
combine that with all the original keys too, which is all, you know, most of these stories came from some form of short story that King had written somewhere. So that's a key too. And I've also got, moving the moving forward kind of thing. One of my keys was Amazing Stories, which was Spielberg's version of an anthology series. My favorite episode of that feels like a Creepshow episode to me. It's called Mummy Daddy. It's the one where the guy is filming a horror movie. He's a mummy. They've accidentally raised a real mummy, but he is an actor trying to get to the hospital because his wife is giving birth. And the mummy is chasing him. And it's a really funny but scary at the same time. It feels like Creepshow.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite episode of Amazing Stories. So
that was one of the originals.
Yeah, it was like the first season, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There are also keys within keys or keys within stories here. We mentioned the color out of space is very reminiscent in the Geordie Verrill story, but the crate is very reminiscent of a non-horror movie and play by Edward Albee called Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I could see that from the characters.
Huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big. Yep. I mean, I don't know if it was in his subconscious or if he was well aware, but there are a lot of elements of that story that ring true to that. So Stephen King had to have been aware of it, I think.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. And I even have another key from that with the crate is the thing too, because the crate itself comes from the Arctic. And it's got a monster expedition. In it. And I
was like, yeah.
And the name of the scientist is like Mrs. Carpenter or something too,
which right. I thought it was all really, intentional.
Yeah, it was all intentional. Yeah,
for sure. And then we mentioned the TV series. You mentioned Carrie with the scare with the hand, Nathan Grantham.
Oh yeah.
You also mentioned the Blob from Geordie Verrill.
Yep.
Which I had not even thought of in the Tommyknockers. And I mentioned the music in the jukebox at the very beginning of the last segment is the exact same song that Sam Raimi uses in The Evil Dead. It's a very unique song and very recognizable, like an old band, like an old swing song from the 30s or something.
And I've got
maybe the 40s.
Oh, I've got Mrs. Danvers, which I love the names. I love Nathan Grantham. I think that's cool. And I'm pretty sure that Grantham is the name from Downton Abbey. I'm pretty sure that's the family name, which would be a kind of a creepy key. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's Grantham.
I don't know about that, but I'm going to put that down. But I will tell you where Danvers comes from. It comes from Rebecca. Mrs. Danvers was the housekeeper in Rebecca. So there's a Hitchcock homage right there.
And my key I have is her death is very Halloween, because the woman opens the door and she's looking for her and the kitchen is empty and the door has the little little window in it, and her face goes into it. And as soon as it does, you hear bum, bum, bum.
Yeah.
Bum.
Yeah.
Bum, bum. You know, with the music, I was going, okay, that's so Halloween. That is so Halloween.
It is. And I love Sylvia, what's her face? Is it Sylvia Grantham or is Sylvia the actress that plays her?
No, Carrie Nye
plays Sylvia Grantham. She's the one that happens to, and then she gets her head twisted off. And she reminds me of like Veronica Lake or Tallulah Bankhead, like one of those old actors from the 40s as well, which is very Hitchcock.
Yeah, a very Hitchcock character. Pass me those
scones, Cass. You're such a hog.
You're such a hog, Henry,
but I suppose you know that.
Oh, and the cigarette.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. She's fabulous.
She is,
and so is the woman that plays her sister at the grave with the bottle drinking.
Oh, Bedelia. Yeah, she's great.
She's great.
Vivica Danvers.
Something like that.
Yeah, she's really good. Her. Yeah. She's another theater actress.
I figured, because theater. They're both just fantastic. And I'm like, why have I never seen these women before?
Yeah.
Fidelia, you bitch.
I have a key to another Stephen King work, which is The Stand.
Okay.
Geordie Verrill's dialogue is a lot like Tom Cullen about, you know, the whole thing about, that's the only kind of luck you have, and you spell that luck B-A-D. You know, that's very lunkhead. Tom Cullen. Yeah.
He calls himself a lunkhead. And then Tom used to say, M-O-O-N, that spells Tom.
That spells Tom. Yeah. And another Jordy Verrill one, which I, you know, very Stephen King in the metaverse and everything. But, you know, the closing shot of that one is the weeds creeping to town and the sign says Castle Rock is 5 miles away. And you hear the guy going, okay, it's going to be wet for the next little while in Castle Rock. Blah, 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 you know,
I loved those little like carryovers.
Oh yeah.
With the, I mean, it's like the box you read at the very last panel of the comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. how, you know, it's not over. It's still going. Yeah. I love that.
And my last key is Jaws, because Chris, or Charlie, the student that everybody's talking about how smart he is, the reason he gets killed is because he says, I want to measure the bite marks.
Oh, yes. I forgot about that.
And I thought, I wonder if that was an homage to Jaws.
Because as soon as he said it, I was like, that's right out of Jaws. Where did that come from?
Yeah, that's Hooper. I want to, you know, the bite radius on this beast is not the same.
And he's got glasses and kind of looks like Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah.
A little bit.
I also remember seeing this and how much you always used to giggle when Dexter would come up and see Charlie in the hall. Charlie's eating chips or doing something. He's walking down the hall and Dexter sees him, goes, and tries to tell him. And Charlie's like, okay. And slowly backing along the wall. And he's going, let's go check it out. And starts, and he's going, no, Charlie, no. The way you would always giggle about Charlie going, sure, dude, I'm just going to go check it out myself.
Well, that's funny because I would always picture like me as Charlie and Steve Roey as like Dexter. Because he would be the one that would be so hysterical and like, no, because he was all over the wall. I mean, he was like, would you really go downstairs if someone was acting that way?
I guess he got his wish. Yeah. Yeah, I could see Roey doing that part. That would be so good.
Yeah.
So needless to say, we love this movie. Like this movie a lot.
A lot. I mean, I had so much fun watching it again because I was like, oh. I don't know. Like I said, I could do almost the entire script watching the movie.
Yeah.
I knew the lines.
And it'll give you a good feeling for Christmas. So everyone should watch it again.
It's a good Christmas.
And enjoy it. Yeah. It is. It's such uplifting about, you know, your wishes will come true. You can get a voodoo doll out of a comic book. So
you can get a voodoo doll. It'll be an online version.
But I loved all those. I mean, if you actually freeze frame it, you know, you can see like the ads that are in the animated things in the comic book are like sea monkeys and, you know, the whole Mr. Strong, just somebody kicks sand at you in the beach. Well, you can, you know, become Mr. Hercules or whatever. It's all those comic book ads that we remember seeing.
Yeah. We could do another comic book when we come back.
We could. We could do a comic book brought to life in a new era. So we'll see.
Quite possibly. Everybody have a happy holiday. We're
going
to take a 3-week break. Quite possibly play some bloopers and or outtakes for you, or not bloopers, but behind the scenes stuff. And we're going
to try to finish Hannibal. You know.
Yeah. Like yeah. Absolutely. And I might finish another season of The Walking Dead.
I'm sure you will, if not two.
I love just going back and watching an entire season. We're going to return on January 10th. Today is 10th. December 13th. So we're going to take 3 weeks off, and we will be back with a bang in January.
Welcome to 2022. Lots of twos in that. So, yeah.
Ooh, that is a lot of twos.
It is a lot of twos.
Martin.
Tim, thank you so much. I hope you and Dennis and everybody have a wonderful holiday.
I hope you and Barbara have the same. And all you folks out there in Cyberland,
yeah.
But, happy holidays. And we'll be seeing you soon.
See you soon.
All right. Bye.